Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to From Tillers to Towers, PL Vulcan Training Concepts. Here are your hosts, Mark Gregory and Pat Nichols.
Good afternoon, everybody. Pat Nichols here. Unfortunately, Mark Gregory is not going to be able to join us for this episode of From Tillers to Towers. Unfortunately, I'm going to give a shout out that we're thinking about Mark and all the members of Tower Ladder 111 and Engine 214 in Brooklyn, as they have lost one of their senior members of Ladder 111, firefighter Chris Wheelahan, passed away suddenly late last week. Over the weekend, and unfortunately, the wake is tonight. Among other events, they are going in as a company, as they should be. I know Mark had mentioned to me that there was quite a showing for a turnout yesterday for the wake last night, and he was, by all accounts, very well liked, very well respected. Certainly, it was Mark's outside vent man, and he certainly will be missed by all the members of Ladder 111. And if we can maybe just give a moment of silence or pause to think about, how precious life is. He was only 54, happened very suddenly, and it just goes to show you that, you should give all your loved ones a hug. So with that being said, I want to thank everybody for listening up tonight. We have a special guest coming on shortly when he calls in. But we have Deputy Chief Jim Puglio from the Mansfield, Massachusetts Fire Department. I'll let Jim introduce himself and give him a little bit of his background. But I know Jim not only personally, but professionally, as we work together in the State Fire Academy. But I've known Jim for a long time. I'm proud to say that I can call him a friend. We go way back. Some of the more memorable moments, certainly, probably can't talk about on the air, but certainly a trip to FDIC about 8 or 9, 10 years ago in my camper with four or five other firefighters was quite memorable, to say the least, and we had a lot of fun, learned a lot. It was a great time, and it was a lot of laughs, that's for sure. We laughed from the moment we left here until we came home. I asked some of you people to post it on Facebook whether, some subject matter, some things that we could, talk about tonight, and I know we got quite a few real good ones. Some of the things that a lot of them came around with ventilation. When to do it, when not to do it, those kind of questions. That's probably one of the most difficult questions that you could probably have, and definitely one of the most fluid ones. It takes a lot of training, a lot of effort. And so that is going to be typically the subject matter of what Jimmy and I are going to talk about. But let me put Jimmy on right now. Jimmy, you're live on the air. How are you?
Good, Pat. How are you?
Good, thank you. Thank you. I just gave a moment of silence, a little remembrance of firefighter Chris Wheelahan and the members of 111 Truck their passing and explaining how the reason why Mark's not going to be here and because of the wake and whatnot. And maybe you could introduce yourself, give it a little background of what you are, or who you are, and where you work and where you've been. I know you've been there for quite a while, but I can do you no justice as far as time on the job and everything like that. And then we could talk about some ventilation, because that was some of the subject questions that came up when I posted it on Facebook.
Okay. As Pat probably told you all, Jim Fulio, Pat and I have been friends for a number of years now, bordering 20. And I have a kind of a mix of experience, both urban and suburban. I've been with the Mansfield Fire Department in Massachusetts now since 1985, off and on. A total of 27 years experience in the fire service. Started as a volley in 1985 and then paid on call and then full-time paid, held the rank of firefighter lieutenant and deputy fire chief now. College educated, served in the military, United States Coast Guard. And I have a mix of experience and training has kind of been a hobby for mine whole life. So been to a number of different schools and classes and that kind of stuff. So my primary responsibilities on the job now are operational, responding to first alarm and better incidents, wide range from EMS type stuff, right through building fires and things like that. So that's where I'm coming from.
Thanks
to Pat for inviting me. And then, of course, it goes without saying, but all the sympathies to 111 Truck down in the city at the loss of their brother. Never a fun time. So I wish Mark and all the members there my best.
Yeah, thanks, Jimmy. That's very true. I'm sure he was, obviously there's priorities, and certainly the priorities to be with your with his company and the family of the of Chris. So, he'll be missed, but we'll try to do our best with holding the fort down, if you will. I did get a couple of before we start. As we spoke about earlier, Jimmy, this afternoon, a lot of questions on ventilation, a lot of things about, seem to be the theme for tonight. But one of the things that somebody has mentioned here, very very infamous photographer and what I would call a friend, Bill Noonan, was talking about ground ladders, and as you well might have seen in Cambridge, I believe it was last night, I think it was the night before, they had three members that were injured throwing a ground ladder when they came in contact with overhead wires. I think that is something that I know we talk about it in the academy as far as making sure that overhead is clear. We almost drill it into the recruit's head so much that it becomes, we like to think it becomes second nature, but when you come out of the drill school and don't throw ground ladders on a regular basis, you may, get a little complacent. And I'm not sure exactly what happened. I haven't spoken to anybody directly, but as I understand it, the 35 was being lowered, and when they went to raise the fly to unlock, the pawls brushed up against the ladder brushed up against the service line. They were not really knocked to their feet or any kind of major injuries or anything like that, but they certainly got a little shock, and they were lucky, certainly throwing ground ladders is, certainly, and I say it a lot, and Jimmy, I'm sure you've heard it, we get very complacent. It seems to be that ground ladders are one of those things that, we throw all the time, or we like to think we do, but we just get a little complacent. And then when it counts, somebody, gets hurt. And fortunately, the members, the brothers, were not hurt severely, but certainly, it just brings back to the fact that we do have to be paying attention, and you can't, and it's the little things. It's the little things, throwing the ground ladders, making sure that overhead is clear, that will get us into trouble if we're not paying attention.
I couldn't agree more, and it's kind of funny you said what we stress at the academy and stuff, and it is a sad fact for all of us, myself included, that probably our peak skill level comes when we graduate to the academy, and it's sort of perishable after that. Having said that, we generally make up or enhance that skill with sound experience, or at least hopefully so, and that makes you a lot more fluent on the fire ground than someone like a recruit. But it is a sad fact too that ground ladders are a lot like our brothers in blue. There's never one around when you need one. But when you need one, it's awfully good to see one. And the fact is that it did kind of go by the wayside. I think a lot of things had to do with cutbacks and the way, especially suburban fire departments, have to run now with very lightly staffed trucks. Our truck is staffed by only two people, sometimes only one. And that is entirely dependent on the volume of EMS calls going on at any one time. Having said that, ground ladders tend to take a back seat until you learn a very hard lesson. And the emphasis on ground laddering needs to be reinstated. And basically what I found is that if you order it, it gets done. So it's incumbent upon a prudent incident commander to get that order out there. Most especially when you're dealing with operations above the fire. If you get a hose line run to the fire floor and you need to get to the floor above to check the extension, a supportive tactic and a good safety practice is to ladder the floor above so that the members have another way out. And that kind of goes hand in hand with what we want to talk to tonight, because you place that ground ladder, you have to ventilate that window so that if you're using that ladder for secondary means of egress, it does you no good to throw the ladder and not take out the glass, which is also ventilation,
Yeah, absolutely. And I know you're a bigger proponent of ground ladders and certainly how important they are. We have a caller, I believe from Arizona, is on hold, so let me get to him before we get into the subject anything further here. Hello, caller, you're live on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, how are you? Who's this, please?
My name's Will Seeley. I'm calling from Tucson, Arizona.
How you doing, Will?
I'm doing great. How are you guys doing?
Very good.
Very good. What
can we do for you tonight, Will?
Oh, I was just listening in, guys. I'm just actually got done working out and try to catch these podcasts anytime I'm available to, and just happened to hit you guys up and don't really have anything. I wasn't even really sure what you guys were talking about today, so I'm just listening in.
Yeah, well, thank you for calling in. Thank you for listening in. I know it's a terrific avenue to be able to ask questions if you have any, but just to listen in. I often have this as background noise, if you will, just to listening and learning on these different podcasts as they go along during the week. Occasionally I'll call in, but more times than not I'm listening, and there's so much to learn, so much to share. It's also a lot of good laughs. I can't say you're going to have a good laugh tonight, but occasionally we do have some pretty funny things go on, and we'll have to see. But thank you for listening in. If I thought you might have had a question, unfortunately tonight we don't have a. I'm not able to screen the calls because it's only myself as the on the switchboard. So, I thought you might have had a question, so I wanted to get to you. But thank you for listening.
Hey, you betcha. I appreciate you guys clicking over and understanding how it is running those switchboards. It seems like a lot of times guys have a little bit of issues. You got to have that IT specialty over. Some guys have it, some guys don't. So I get it.
Yeah,
well, that's
exactly
right. Pat's running the computer tonight. A Touchstone phone is just over my head, you know?
Exactly. The old rotary phones, that's about my speed.
Yep. Works for me.
Now, let me ask you, Will, while we have you on the line, and since you're calling from Tucson, Arizona, tell me about the weather there today.
Where are you at?
I'm in Boston. We're both calling out of Boston.
Yeah, it's about, I think it was about 72 degrees today, maybe a couple clouds in the sky, little breeze, so it felt like about 68.
Wind chill factor, huh?
Yeah, wind chill of about maybe 5 mph.
Well, we crested at about 40 today, and it's a little bit raw, so.
Oh, very, very nice.
Cloudy all day long.
Perfect.
Mm.
Which I must say has been a record for this area and this time of the year as far as how mild and how lack of snow we have. So I guess that's a good thing. But it certainly doesn't beat the Tucson, Arizona weather, that's for sure.
Yeah, we'll talk again in the summer, and then you guys can rub it in a little bit when we're hitting about 120.
Yeah.
And I'm a big
go.
Heavy set guy, so I really don't like that 120 stuff. Stuff starts to get real hot.
Yep, I hear you, bro. I hear you. So
we're
going to
be talking about ventilation tonight, Will. We're going to try to concentrate on vertical ventilation.
Awesome.
I just kind of wonder your opinion. Tucson is a fairly large city.
I actually work for a fire district just north of Tucson. We're 7 stations. We have a 105-foot elevated platform in our district. So I don't work for the city. I'm in a smaller district, but that's what we have. We have one ladder truck in our district, but we have a ladder truck with an associated LT. So
with a quick hit then on your experience, do you tend to rely more on vertical ventilation or horizontal?
You know what? It all depends. We've done a really good job with our district as far as stressing vertical ventilation. I've had I've been a captain 5 years. I've had 3 lightning strike attic fires in one of our retirement communities up north in our northern part of a district. So our ladder's kept down in the southern part, so it takes them probably getting up the hill. It takes a good 15 to 20 minutes. So by the time they get rolling up there, we've already pretty much established an inside vent because we've got 2 stations pretty close that we're able to get 2 to 3 engine companies there pretty quickly. With the attic fires, you know, we've done both where we've pulled some inside drywall and steam converted it, been able to knock it down, and then we've also had to go and pop the top with a coordinated interior attack. So we've done both. Again, it's hard, you know, each one is situational. We're not afraid to get up on the roof and cut a hole. We're trying to see if we can, you know, if we do have a full-blown attic fire where we can just kind of steam convert it, we'll make that attempt. Otherwise, I mean, we'll get an engine company up there and cut the hole and get them off.
Yeah, a lot of terracotta tile roofs out there?
Absolutely. We've got the, you know, pitch tiled roofs, ordinary construction, you know, newer facility. I mean, Saddlebrook homes were built, we put a station up there in 92. So they're hitting about 30 years old now. No, 20. I'm sorry, 20 years old.
Yep.
So our district's been around since 78. We're, you know, we have 2 retirement communities on each side of our district, the north and the south. We have Sun City, and then we have the Saddlebrook communities. And then we have in the middle is kind of a trailer, rural type, nice homes up on the side of the mountain. But we have some trailer communities and a low-income housing area in the middle, and then we have a town, Oral Valley, which is a high dollar town. It's you know, like the Scottsdale of Tucson. So we have, you know, moderate construction, you know, big homes in our area as well. So we have a little bit of everything. We've got commercial down south and kind of the whole gambit.
Excellent. Pat, we don't deal too often with terracotta tile around here. Slate maybe, but up in the Northeast, terracotta tile would be considered kind of rare, I would think.
Yeah, I can't think of. I know there's a few around, but they're definitely few and far between. I don't. I know there's actually in the neighborhood that I work in, and part of the neighborhood I work in Jamaica Plain, which is part of the city of Boston. We do actually have a couple of terracotta, but those are more the renovated structures that are trying to get a particular look. But yes, that's true. The Northeast generally doesn't have too many of them.
Yeah, our challenge here is asphalt shingle. And how about balloon frame construction? You mentioned attic fires quite a bit, and kind of a rule of thumb around here for vertical ventilation is really twofold. A cellar fire in a balloon frame constructed house, you want to hit the roof as quickly as you can. And then, of course, a top floor fire, it has nowhere else to go. So in order to prevent it from going horizontally, those are two automatics that we use in our department. I know, Pat, your staffing levels allow you to engage in simultaneous tactics.
Yeah, we're fortunate in that respect, and like we spoke earlier about Jimmy, we have 32 people on the first alarm, and even if the first eight people, four on each the engine and the truck, the first eight people, we're not very much delayed by 4 or 5 minutes for the next companies coming in. So there isn't a big, huge gap, and that's very rare. Most of the companies are, on scene in 6 minutes. So that's not to say that might not occur, but certainly, I'm fortunate with the fact that we can do dual tactics and attack the fire in many different facets, like New York. But now you Jimmy, have certainly a smaller pool of people, at least initially, with eight people. Where do you tend to have your priorities?
We've been successful, stressing horizontal ventilation. With suburban manpower comes suburban fire experience, and I can say it to you that a bread and butter type operation is not greater than a two-room fire. A lot of kitchens and things of that, a bedroom. That's not to say that some of them don't take off well before we get there or whatever, but we've gained a lot of success with, I guess, the vent ahead of the hose stream kind of take out the window in the fire room and allow the engine company to make the push there. And then the secondary approach is to consider the roof, largely based on staffing, like I said, but also largely based on some pretty successful experience with what our workload offers. We're fairly successful getting one or two windows, the fire room, maybe the room adjacent or just above. And we seem to get a pretty good lift that way. We can emphasize and we have good flow on our hose lines. So, it's much easier for us to emphasize the horizontal vent. And it gives us an opportunity, too, to have a ground ladder placed fairly quickly. So kind of a page out of one tactic that a more urban truck might do, and our members will routinely take a 16 or a 20-foot straight wall ladder with a 6 or an 8-foot hook, rake, or pike pole, whatever term you use from whatever part of the country, and we call it take the hot window. And if they can knock that window out, hopefully it's a good enough vent to at least allow the engine company to advance on the interior. How's that sound to you, Will? You still there?
Yes, I'm here. Yeah, I'm just I've never actually – I worked on our ladder truck probably about 10 years ago. I'm not a huge truckie, as you say. I'm not – like I said, I'm a pretty big boy, and getting on and off that That ladder is not my forte, but I'm, you know, being a captain for 5 years now, I'm thinking about taking that Chiefs test and would like to get a little bit of experience working on both sides. I'll never get the captain out of there, but being able to maybe pick up some overtime or whatnot working on that ladder would be a pretty cool thing. But I've just been trying to soak up. Number one, we don't run a boatload of fires in our district. We'll maybe run, I don't know, maybe 10 a year for 7 stations. We're amazingly our not smartest people in the world are pretty smart and able to put out their own fires when it seems like the surrounding areas are lighting off every other day. So it's a little frustrating on that end that we don't get a lot of actual fire experience. So we're doing a lot of training and whatnot. But anytime I can listen to these classes and listen to these experienced truck guys talk about some of the things that they've done and encountered has been awesome. You know, it's just been it's a great opportunity to learn from the best.
Well, never having met us, thanks a lot. And I certainly wouldn't describe myself as a ballerina. So getting on and off a ladder is just one of those things we do, you know.
Yes.
Again,
yeah,
my experience. I did serve on an urban ladder company for a little while, but the majority of my experience is suburban. And when you operate like us, you're probably in the middle between Pat and I, staffing and response location, where I might be able to beat your response time with a ladder truck. It's arriving with one or two people. So, you know, there's challenges all over the place, and certainly discussions like this help everybody. So thanks for your
input. Yeah. No, I appreciate it. I mean, we've come a long way from when I started. We were, you know, running 3-man engine companies, 3 stations, homemade. You know, basically it was one brother was the chief, the other brother was the head mechanic, the wife was the assistant chief. And, you know, honestly, that's where we were. And the name of my department is Golder Ranch. And, I mean, guys used to give us a really hard time about, oh, you guys riding horses to the ranch and da-da-da-da-da. And, I mean, we've completely changed the image, the mentality, the tradition here. You know, we're out training. We've got the 100-foot platform that, you know, this LT is probably one of the nicest trucks in this in the area. And people are coming to look at it to check it out. And it's just that mentality. And then we've got specialty guys that are just working on these ladder trucks. And, you know, it used to be, you know, okay, you're driving today, you're the this today, but now we have engineers, we have medics, we have captains. And, you know, you have to be, in order to work on the ladder, you have to be ladder qualified. You got to go to the class, you got to be signed off, and not just anybody can go in there and work the truck. So we are making the right steps. And, you know, we have team 1, team 2, team 3 with the ambulance there. Those guys work as a team 3, so they're able to put two guys up on the roof, two guys throw on external ladders, and then team 3 can go assist with salvage or search or utilities or whatever the case may be. So it's been awesome to watch the evolution of our growth and just continuing to hope to improve on those in these crunch times. I mean, that's one of the things that we've worked really hard at is at least maintaining what we currently have.
Excellent. Keep moving. As everybody in the phone line is well aware, there's really only two ways to win this game, gallons per minute and getting rid of the heat, right?
And, you got it, man.
So you got to get rid of the heat by adding water and ventilating.
You bet. Pretty simple.
Yeah.
Sometimes it doesn't work that well, but it sounds pretty simple on paper, at least.
It sounds good on paper. That's right, bro.
Yeah.
But thanks, Will, for calling in. You know, it's great to hear from the West Coast. We don't seem to get I shouldn't say that. We occasionally we'll get some Midwest, West Coast, and I'm not sure if Arizona is considered really truly the West Coast or just the Midwest. I'm not sure.
Yeah, we're kind of Southwest. Us in New Mexico kind of are considered Southwest, and we don't have the surf of California, so we're not really laid back cool like them, and we get super hot in the summer. So,
yeah,
it's outside of 495, right, Pat?
Yeah, I think so. That's why I'm not familiar with it, you know.
That's a major Northwest highway in Massachusetts. It kind of cuts the state in, well, actually 1/3, but it's one of those deals.
Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, anybody that's west of 495, we're sometimes we don't know what's where they are, you know.
Very nice.
Of course, that's all in good fun, you know, for all those out there, you know.
You bet.
But do you have a let me ask you something, Will, while we have you on the line, and I can pick your brains a little bit.
I would imagine.
Well, with the newer construction, that you tend to have quite a few truss type construction, both roof and flooring, correct?
Absolutely, yep. Mainly just the roof. We're not seeing a lot of the flooring stuff out here.
Oh, you're not? Interesting.
No, we don't have a whole bunch of two-story. We have mainly single-story residential structures. A lot of trailers in my first due area, and then, like I said, the two-story or single-story in our other areas.
Yeah. Okay. So my question was really, what is your procedures for operating on truss roofs? Do you is there a time limit as far as operating on them? Do you stay away from them? Do you operate? You said you had a tower. Do you strictly operate from the tower?
No. You know, years back, you know, Phoenix had that person fall through. I mean, this was years and years ago. And there was, it used to be going around that we weren't going to put anybody on tiled roofs. Well, then you kind of you limited yourself because that's all we really have. So we really got back to the basics and really concentrated on situational awareness, paying attention, having our officers really do a good 360, getting around, evaluating whether it's again, and this falls back on getting the right people on that ladder truck that are able to make these decisions, you know, sizing up the roof. Being aware that, yes, we have a limited amount of time, how long it's been burning. With our seven stations, we're able to get to these calls pretty rapidly, at least get one or two pieces of equipment there within usually less than 10 minutes. So we're able to get a good knockdown or get a good response. I don't want to say that we have a specific rule that absolutely not, we're not going to go on the roof if this or that. It's all dependent. We don't have a policy in place as far as you will not go on these roofs, you will not do this, or you will not do that. They've put a lot of the emphasis back on the company officer and our chief officers to make the determination where they feel that it's tenable or untenable.
Oh, good. Now, you know, some of these SOPs or SOGs, hamstring you to to so specific things that that you really can't do your job when, you know, it should be part of the size-up process, whether, you know, including, maybe in a 360 walk around, which in the city of Austin is a lot of times not possible, or actually in the Northeast, a lot of places in the urban areas is almost not possible. But when it is, take that into account. And observation your experience, and take all that into account, whether it's appropriate to be in the position where you are, whether it be, you know, a floor above the fire doing a search, or whether it be on a roof or on a truss roof in this respect as we talk.
You know, Pat, you said two words there that kind of tipped me off. Will said back to basics, and you just mentioned experience, and I think in conversations like this, it's pretty easy to avoid, but for people that might be just, say, listening and just kind of taking it, one of the things that needs to be understood is that any one training issue that you either conduct or, attend or read or look pictures at, study a video, whatever the case may be, isn't a standalone gospel. And you know, by Will saying back to basics and by you using experience, I'm oftentimes think of, you know, people pick up a trade magazine, they read this is how you're supposed to cut a roof and when you're supposed to cut a roof, and then they just do that and lose sight of the fact that, you know, in Will's case, his truck might have a 10 or 15 minute response time, or my truck might get there with only two people on it and it's a four-man job. So everything has to be tailored, I think, with the basic premise in mind of what's our what's our final objective here, and what's the experience? And using the size up, I thought that was a great point. Because, you know, as you're responding to these things, especially when you're in the red car, you're responding to these things and say, all right, these are my consistent objectives, line on the fire floor, line on the floor above, primary surge, vent ahead of the hose stream, vertical ventilation. Well, up here when you're starting to deal with a lot of truss construction or you're dealing with an extended burn time or an extended response time, you can't just go down that mental checklist without looking at what's the building doing? What is my problem here? You know, my problem is I got an underventilated fire, but it's been burning for 25 minutes. My real problem is the building's about to fall down, and there's no sense being on the roof at that point, you know?
Yeah, absolutely, Jimmy. You're 100% on that. I think that has to do with, so many people want to go to drill school, do their thing in drill school, I'm graduated, and now my training stops. Well, and the reality of it is the training doesn't stop. The training shouldn't stop until you retire, and maybe even after you retire. I mean, you could always learn something from somebody. And I mentioned this earlier, Will, when we were talking about, listening to these podcasts and learning from everybody, and nobody knows everything about everything. You may think your department is the best in the world, and it may be, but that doesn't mean you can't learn from somebody. I think we sometimes lose sight of that, you know?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've been able to meet so many cool people listening to these podcasts. You know, it's awesome. You hear Chief Bruinsini, Ed Hatfield, you guys listening to Chief Mittendorf on the other day, just talking about things. And it's funny, he was talking about SOPs the other day, you know, the different type of putting guys up on a stick for an elevated master stream. Should you do it or should you not? Some people say, absolutely not. You can't ever do that. And he said, are you crazy? You know what I mean? It's just, I love the fact that the guys are putting their phone numbers out here, they're putting their emails out here, and all you have to do is call them up and say, hey, what do you think about this? And you just build that mentor, that networking and that mentorship, and that's how we learn. And you guys talking about going to school and then forgetting about it, and that's what's so great about our department is we are young. I think the average age of our guys is probably about 28 years old. Average time on is maybe 8 years. But we've got some young and up-and-coming superstars, and then we've got some guys that are promoting probably a little bit too early. So, I mean, we've got a good mix, and our training division isn't where it needs to be, but we're working on it. We know that that's one of the things that we need to work on. And any opportunity, like I said, every day I try to listen to one of these things, and if I can't listen to it the day of, I'll listen to it the day after on the archives, and you'll always pick up one or two things that you could put in your toolbox and take it back to the crew. And if that one thing, and you know, every fire you go on, every call you go on, you need to learn from it. And anytime you can drill and make the mistakes out on the drill ground, that's where you want to make them, not on the real deal.
No, I couldn't agree more. Yeah. And Pat and I work together a lot in the Massachusetts Fire Academy, where we run probationary firefighters through a basic firefighting course. It lasts like 12 weeks, and there's 72 at a time. And one of the more consistent messages we always send to them is, you know, after every job, no matter what you did, retrace your steps and understand, you know, why it tripped and stumbled here, or why it was so hot in this location, or whatever it is that you went through, and kind of file that away so that you get to see that in a calmer state, you know, you're not all pumped up on adrenaline and the smoke isn't obscuring your vision or any of that kind of stuff. You go through the steps afterwards again, and that way, if in fact it was a mistake or a misstep or something that, geez, I didn't know that hole in the floor was there, you can kind of file that away in your memory, and it'll emphasize things like the basics, like, you know, sounding the floor or using a roof ladder or whatever the case may be.
Yep. You put it in the toolkit, in the tool chest. That's what you got to do.
Sure.
But yeah, they that's true. The other thing, Will, are you still there?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I was just you know, just talking about ladder, you know, since we're this is kind of a ladder thing, but not necessarily strictly ladder stuff. But do you run your aerial truck? You said it was a tower, correct?
Yeah, it's a platform, 105 foot. I guess that's how you call it. I don't know, 105 foot platform. Yeah.
Yeah, platform, tower, rake, pike pole. You know.
Yeah, you know what, we do call it a tower. You're right. Yes, sir.
And now I was wondering, is the priority for the ladder truck, the tower, the platform, to get to the front of the building? Is that the priority, or is that not thought about?
You know, any commercial assignment, we always get them right. Well, most of the time we get them up to the front. We always try to leave room for them on our – it depends on where the call is. And, again, we have that LT that rides with them. So they'll toggle between the two, and depending on the area, they might just bring the ladder, the tender, which doesn't have the stick on it, but it has all the complement of all the other equipment except for the platform. So a lot of times we'll just...
Not to interrupt you, Will, but LT up here might mean a lieutenant. You're talking about a ladder tender.
Yeah, ladder tender. I'm sorry.
No,
it's a ladder tender truck.
Which is a separate piece of apparatus than a ladder truck?
Yes, sir. It's staged or it's housed at the same house, and it's you know, it's basically, it looks like a fire engine, but it's got the 35 foot ladders. It's got all the ladders. It just doesn't have the platform on it. But
okay.
It has all the same equipment that the ladder truck has. And it's a little bit, it's smaller. It's more maneuverable to get into some of the areas in our district.
You got a couple of those, Pat?
Well, every one of our we're either an engine or a ladder truck. That's how Boston runs it. But we, you know, every ladder truck, I'm sorry, every engine company has at least a 24 foot ladder on it, along with a roof ladder. But typically, at least in the city of Boston, we are very truck heavy. We have 33 engines and 21 trucks.
Jeez.
At least two engines. I'm sorry. Excuse me. At least two trucks on every building fire, and a rescue company that could either operate as a truck company or as an engine company, depending upon the situation. But typically, they operate in a quasi truck mode. So we're very heavy on ladder operations and making sure the front of the building is open for the ladder truck so they can get the ladders to the roof or to sides of buildings. Most of our stuff, not all of it, of course, some neighborhoods do have one story and two, you know, one and a half story capes, but most of this Boston is two and three story buildings, so it's imperative to get ladders in place, whether it be ground ladders or aerial ladders and or platforms. So we're heavy emphasis on the truck work, and that's why it's interesting to talk to people in other parts of the country how they operate and you know, learn from them and see how other people are doing it.
Yeah, our typical response for a house fire would be three engines and a ladder with a medic truck and a chief. So that we'll have, it used to be two in one, but now we have a third engine that's called the on-deck engine. It's kind of a rig on deck, and they rotate in, and once that first crew goes through their bottle, those guys will go in and assume interior operations. So it's kind of, it builds up a rotation. But that's our response. So having we'll always try to leave the front for the ladder tender, to either the ladder tender or the truck, depending on where it is. But again, the biggest building in our district is I want to say a four story hospital. Most of our stuff is two story or less.
Okay.
So yeah. Again, the emphasis is a little bit different. You know, we have quite a few two-story residential truck or houses, but all our engines carry 24-foot ladders as well as a 14 and a 10. But the LT, or I'm sorry, the ladder tender, the ladder, and then our equipment truck each have 35-footers.
Okay.
Excellent. That's a little bit better than understanding, Pat. When he kept saying LT, I thought, and this isn't, you know, trying to bust your chops, I thought that there was a lieutenant on the apparatus that was making these decisions on placement and stuff like that. But
no, sir, I apologize for that. Our LT is I call it our ladder tender.
Yeah. No, it's
all our trucks have captains. We don't have lieutenants. We have captains.
Outstanding. I got it.
Yeah, it's interesting to see, which is, you know, the beauty of having a national and actually international audience is that, as we've had people from Australia call us, that, you know, how different things are in different regions. And working and being a co-owner, and Jimmy also working with PL Vulcan Training Concepts, we go around the country and Canada, and it's very interesting to see how other people accomplish the same task. And it's not one way is right or better than the other, but like you said earlier, Will, is that you could put tools in your tool chest, learn from others, and gather experience and soak up that experience from others that have been fortunate enough to experience and just become better at what you do.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Let me throw this question out for you, Pat, Will, both. We're just trying to consider a little bit more on ventilation, and I know we fielded a couple of questions earlier on about vertical vent versus horizontal vent, or emphasizing vertical vent. Let's throw out there natural openings versus, firefighter made, if you will. Roof cuts versus skylights, scuttle hatches, vent shafts, light shafts, things like that. For Will, those types of things are very common up here in New England. Skylights and the such, I suppose you have them too. But a light shaft or a light well is an entirely different thing, and we have some weird roof construction out here, sawtooth roof and monitors, they call them, bulkheads on roofs, which open up to stairways and stuff. In the material that we read and often publish, it always says go for the natural openings first, knock out a skylight or something similar, and then try to cut the roof. I know that where Pat works is a lot of three-deckers, and those have scuttle hatches on them, but location can sometimes be a problem with those natural openings, can't they, Pat?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And the thing about the natural ventilation, those skylights and those kind of things, is that they typically open up to occupant areas. In other words, the places that either civilians and or firefighters are making their way into, and to release some of that pressure, some of that smoke, some of that maybe even fire, makes a big difference, and it is certainly a much prudent use of your immediate time as opposed to attacking the roof boards, which is much more time consuming and just opens a void space, whether it be a cock loft or a
attic.
Attic space, right.
The interesting part about that, and you hit right on it, is labor intensive, and that's one of the choices that suburban guys, like where I work, might have the ability to do a whole lot of good real quick, rather than firing up the saws or going at it with a roof axe or something along that line.
Yeah, but we have to be careful. As a friend of mine from a nearby city adjacent to Boston, is points out that certainly in the improper ventilation of a light shaft or any kind of a open natural ventilation, if you will, could cause spread to other parts of the building, and that's very true. And again, I think that comes down to a similar conversation that we had with the truss roofs, and that's part of the size up and what is happening with the building and what is really going on with the fire. Are they making progress? Is there water on the fire? I always like listening to whether.
Hey guys, I got to run. I'll talk to you soon. I got to go.
All right, Will. Good luck.
Thanks, guys.
Hey, Will.
Bye.
Be safe. Thanks. I just lost my train of thought. That's awful.
Well, we were talking about using natural ventilations and how you can draw the fire to where you may not want it to go.
Right. And they, again, it's about doing that size up and the experience and whatnot. I think you got to decipher between, what kind of roof are we on? What is it, a pitch roof, or is it a flat roof? Those things are different animals almost to each individual, so each individual incident might be a little bit different in respect to what the tactics might be. And so there's really no right or wrong answer. And when I was reading these about, doing a search and, when I asked on Facebook whether, what were some of the ideas that people wanted to listen to, about when to vent and when not to vent, and, when you're searching above the floor, do you vent, or, when does that happen? They have, that all comes down to, is there water on the fire? Well, how do I know there's water on the fire? Well, did the engine company call for water? Yes or no? Did they get that water? Are they calling for more pressure? Is anybody talking about, a frozen hydrant for us in the Northeast? Is anybody talking about, a busted hose line, which we don't see too many often as much as we did with the cotton jacketed, but nonetheless, that's certainly a potential. And, some of the things that happen on the radio, you can get a lot of information, and I'm sure you can agree with me, Jimmy, but you don't have to talk on the radio, but you certainly can gather a lot of information just by listening to what's going on and taking that all part of the your size up. Just because everybody should, and it's good fire ground practice, and these days, hopefully everybody has a radio as part of their safety ensemble, but nonetheless, you should be operating with somebody who has a radio and listening to that radio and what's going on and gathering information by what is being said. The other thing is knowing that company officer on that engine, when that voice is a little bit higher than normal, and he's usually a very calm, collective dude on the radio, and it's not happening, then things aren't right. And, maybe you want to hold off on some of the things that you might have normally taken for granted, which is, taking out every window you can or whatever. So some of the things, those are the things I think we have to look into. Again, it's experience.
Yeah, and I think you hit the nail on the head a couple of times with, the radio issue. That button is pushed to talk, but more importantly, it's released to listen. And, it's one of those things where...
I like
that.
I'm going to use that, Jimmy.
I should probably follow my own advice sometimes, I guess. But here's the fact that the radio is a great tool. You can use it as a recon tool, listening to what other people say. But strict radio discipline, probably a matter for another show, stick to a certain format. Get your assignment, let us know when the assignment's done, or if it cannot be done, fill it in. But as far as radio and back, this is ladder one, and we're doing a primary search on the second floor. We're venting as we go. I've completed one bedroom. I'm in the hallway now, calling back and saying I'm in the second bedroom. You know, there's a certain amount of, I don't know, leadership and an expectation between an incident commander and a company commander that if the incident commander says go up and search the second floor, that there are, you know, a whole bunch of subset tactics that go on with that. One of them is ventilating as you go, if appropriate. The other one is maintaining an eye on conditions and, you know, radioing back appropriate information and not just monitoring the progress. That's a good thing. But what if you don't have a radio, and how do you know when or if to ventilate? And, you know, you mentioned the floor above the fire, and I know on more than one occasions you have, and I certainly have probably less occasions, but felt that you can feel the hose stream hit the floor below you. You can hear it, you know, that kind of a sort of a dull roar on occasion. Now, if you're in a very urban area with a lot of multiple ceilings and renovations, that's going to be a little bit more difficult to do. You know, in suburbia, we don't get on the floor above the fire as quickly as perhaps they do in a more urban setting where, you know, the quick stretching of a backup line or a line on the floor above is more of an assumed duty, and you can put faith in the other companies that they're going to get here, but that's personnel-based. And in suburbia, you don't always have the right amount of people to get the job done. And, you know, it's going to take a little bit longer. So, you know, your own department's experience and knowing who you are and where you are plays a big role in it.
Yeah, knowing your job and knowing who's coming is huge. And again, I've said it a number of times, and, you know, it's the experience. It's your experience. They don't put probationary firemen in the front seat to make decisions, typically. And I say typically because that occasionally happens. But with that being said, typically, because they need some experience. They need to base some of those decisions, you need to have real-world, true experience. You can gather some of that experience through training, but you can't take away true, real-life incidents. But you could certainly learn from other people from incidents, you know, whether it be a forum like this, a training forum, whether it be, you know, your own state academy, your own fire department academy, you know, outside vendors, outside people, you know, like PL Vulcan or others that are out there, you know, to share experiences that other people have been lucky enough to experience, you know, and that's how you learn. For people to think that they are just, they're there, I'm on the job and my training's over, is foolish. You're doing a disservice to not only your job, but to the fire service in general.
And to the people that you work with, more importantly, your brothers, the guy that's in the seat right next to you, needs to know that you're as current as you can be, because in all likelihood, you're rolling into something that he's never seen before and you have, and then the very next run you go on, you might never have seen it, but he has. And if you don't trade off those ideas and kind of, you know, benefit from each other's experiences, then you can do it. And, of course, the second half of any training equation out there is once you learn something or you sit and listen to one of these things, you got to have the stones to implement it. And, you know, you just say, well, I was listening to Nichols talk on the radio the other day, and he said, if you can make a quick hit on a skylight, that's going to relieve the things. Well, the next time you're up on the roof and you see a skylight and it is above the fire, even though the chief told you he wants you to cut the roof, you got to be able to understand that sometimes you can do a lot of good quickly by, you know, all right, I'm going to hit this skylight, then I'm going to cut the roof. You know, and that comes with, you know, what Pat said is more experience and the ability to apply with what you learn. And that's kind of, I think, the hope of anybody that considers themselves an instructor. We can certainly spit back any textbook you want, but the fact is that you fill in a lot with anecdotal stories, and we used to call them war stories, I guess, and then hope that the people that you're talking with aren't afraid to try whatever worked for you. It's best practices kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, that's very true. And I know Fire Engineering has a great series of short videos, training videos, training minutes, which Mark Gregory and I are going to be involved with when we go to FDIC. But there's certainly a tremendous amount of information you can get off the Internet. But I would caution people to use a filter. And I mean that in the sense that there is some things that you could say, oh, geez, I would never do that, but somebody did, and, you know, maybe something bad happened, but it's the way I look at a lot of those videos, and not specifically talking about fire engineering training videos, I'm thinking more along the lines of going the other route, places like YouTube or, you know, those kind of, you know, where pretty much unfiltered video could be put on pretty much before you even get back to the firehouse of a particular incident. And in, you know, granted it may be a shot, you know, a time frame, you know, a 30-second frame of, you know, an overall incident that doesn't do the whole fire or the whole incident any justice, but nonetheless, it's out there. And people use it and will bash on it, where I think you could use, as opposed to using it as a bashing system or a bashing venue, is that use it as constructive criticism. You know, well, you know, they did this. Why did they do that? What were they looking at? And use it as a learning tool. Don't necessarily look at a particular video. And I'm not thinking of anything specific. I'm just talking all generalities at the moment. But if you talk, if you look at a video and talk amongst your members and say, you know, maybe you can get some constructive things out of it, as opposed to, well, I can't believe they did that. They, you know, they suck or whatever it is that you say, that really doesn't do anything any justice. Instead, look at those videos and try to learn from them, whether it's good or bad, you know?
I agree with you wholeheartedly, Pat. I mean, the thing that's popping into my head right now is you know, it's game film. You know, you're watching perhaps your own department or other companies within your department, or maybe another department across the world, who knows, play the very same game you're about to play within minutes. And if you look at it from that standpoint, and you throw the term out there, brother, you know, it'd be nothing for Pat and I to be somewhere and have a Jake from California or even a foreign country use the term brother. Well, if they're our brothers, we're all on the same team. There's no sense in getting into a blog and kicking the snot out of somebody else. Use it as game film. All right, this is, you know, this fire is the New York Giants defense on Sunday, and you know the home team. Yeah, and the home team has to look at what the Giants scheme is and make a play, and the same thing can be done on YouTube. There's some invaluable stuff. We use it all the time. You know, all you have to do is punch in ventilation practices in YouTube, and you come up with a bunch of tremendous videos that of showing great vents work and good saw work and safety practices on the roof and stuff. So, you know, YouTube and the Internet itself is a valuable tool. I'd just skip all the blog afterwards. There's some very notable websites out there that, you know, just allow some craziness, you know. And you can often tell people will write in and they fail to realize that, you know, you're watching a video clip of 3 minutes, and it was a four-hour operation, and you don't know where that 3 minutes took place in that four-hour operation. So I think your advice is well-intended. Use it as game film and say, all right, brothers, we're presented with this tactical problem right now. How are we going to ventilate it, or where are we going to stretch our first line, or, you know, this department arrives with 40 men, and we're going to arrive with eight. Having said that, we're going to still need to achieve all of these objectives in order to be successful. How are we going to do that? You know, well, we're going to call for more help early, you know, enact our standard operating procedures this way. Start off with, I don't know, a bigger line, or start off with roof ventilation as opposed to horizontal ventilation. That's the value in the internet.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can see what went wrong and what didn't get wrong. As a friend of ours that we mentioned from the Cape just mentions on the chat room, you know, taking a window and watching when he shouldn't have, or he or she shouldn't have, and watching what happens. That gives somebody a real-time lesson of what maybe could go wrong. And it's, I think it, you know, that's very true. I mean, I don't mean that in the sense that that we should be looking at, you know, and bashing a particular department. You don't have to even know which department it's from. It doesn't make any difference. That's not the point. We all make mistakes. If we can learn from them, and our members and our people that we're working with and for can learn from it, it's all the better.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's sitting there and name calling. My dad always used to say, not on the job, but one of the smartest guys I know, he'd have made a hell of a fireman. Always used to say, as soon as the name calling starts, you know you won the argument. So there's no real sense whatsoever in, you know, saying, you know, look at this ladder truck. They don't even know how to throw the stick, or whatever the case may be. You're missing the objective here. The question is, do we throw the stick or not in this situation? Do we ventilate high on them, or do we go with the windows on this? I think it really does offer you, you can't really substitute real life experience, but you know what, if you're in a position where, and everybody claims there is, the Jakes that want to do this job for real all say the same thing, we don't get enough fires, well, You start looking at your stats, and you are going to fights. They may not be as big or as glorious as they were in you know, pre-smoke detector era in the 70s, but there's some incidents out there, and you know, hazards are different now. Smoke production is different now. Heat production is different now. Staffing isn't getting any better whatsoever. For those of us in suburbia, there's a real population shift that's palpable. And in addition, those of us in suburbia operate with EMS, so that kind of chews up your staffing. And when, you know, when the fire comes in and your ambulance is out, you can't be just an engine guy or just a truck guy. You have to be cross-trained, and everybody has to really be on their A game, whether it's engine, truck, vent, water supply, whatever the tactical situation needs. You got to be on your game. I think, you know, studying video and using some of the websites out there. I know PL put some articles up there, reading it, and then trying to make it apply to you. And I think that's a way to go. It's a good way to stay current.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other part of that, I just, you know, it's funny that Paul Trahan just put it in there, which is what I, as you were talking, I was thinking that we have, the fire service in general is dealing with situations now that, you know, those before us didn't have to, and that is, you know, early detection, you know, prompt response times, faster response times, apparatus that hopefully works and starts. So we're getting there maybe even before flashover. So now we're dealing with incidents where, you know, we're dealing more and more with, you know, flashovers, things like, you know, thermal pane windows and things that are making our life generally better are putting extra wrenches in the works as far as the firefighting goes. And those that came before us certainly had their, the volume and, lack of equipment and all those things. But I think those that are coming now and, both Jimmy's and my son's both aspire to be in the fire service somewhere, and which is, I guess it's something to be said about our lifestyles. But I think, these are some of the things that they're going to have to worry about and have to deal with, as opposed to, whether we have enough masks for everybody on the backstop, and there was only one or two to share. And that was kind of the beginning of my career. They just began having enough masks for everybody. And, now it's like unheard of not having an air mask, at all,
Oh, yeah. In lots of evolution when you think of it. We think of good friends of ours that maybe have recently retired that started in the late 60s and stuff. The smoke production that they were witnessing was oftentimes, that gray cotton batting mattress type stuff, smoke. And now what we're seeing is that black churning petroleum-based thing that members before us were used to seeing at maybe arson fires, and we're seeing them at nickel and dime mattress fires. And the volume of smoke that's being produced, the amount of heat that's being produced over a simple mattress fire now is far greater, and we have earlier detection and things like that. So it could be argued that back in the glory days, and we all wish we were there, a building was well alight, it was also well ventilated. Nowadays we're not getting that lucky, so all over the time, you just keep practicing and hope that it goes the way it's supposed to go,
Yeah, and frozen flammable liquids is what I equate our response to furnishings these days in buildings. I mean, if I'm just looking around in my my den that I'm working out of right now, and everything is frozen flammable liquids. I mean, everything is a plastic base. It comes from the computer to a whole bunch of paper that I have to get to someday, and to the chair that I'm sitting on, to the couch that's behind me. All this is just it's a plastic petroleum based product that does that that burns so much differently, so much hotter, so much ferociously than it did before. And then we used to be able to drop ladders into windows and take them out. That doesn't you pretty much can't do that anymore. I mean, not without great difficulty. You have to get up there and actually take the windows out. I mean, there was a high-rise fire I went to. I don't want to talk war stories, but a couple, 3 years ago when I was a captain of Ladder 26, and we ended up working off the exposure, which was the roof of the exposure on the high rise that was under construction. And anyway, long story short, we took the windows out of the fire floor, and the first swing I took, the axe came back at me, and the next swing I took barely made a crack. So it was a great amount of work to take these windows out. And maybe that's, yes, granted it was a high rise, but and maybe to that extent, some of these thermal pane, double pane, triple pane windows that we deal with in our residence affect our ventilation as well. These are all the things that are changing the way we do business.
Yep, and you just look at the transition there, single pane to thermal pane. And the last time you and I were at FDIC, we had an opportunity. We were down there with a friend of ours from the Brockton Fire Department, who was learning how to cut glass windows with a chainsaw. And it was considered a viable tactic, and it's worthy. Incidentally, John says to say thank you for the shout-out. I'm glad to hear that he's listening to some fire-related stuff and not playing video games while he's at school.
Well, I'm glad. John being your son, who's right now at the University of New Haven, correct? And for the fire school, correct?
That's right. Yep.
I just want to make sure everybody knows that. So I'm giving him a shout out. So I'm glad. My oldest son is currently serving in the U.S. Army, and he's stationed down in Savannah right now, and he is actually a volunteer fireman at a since he is able to live off campus, off base, I should say, off base, and
different kind of call.
Fire department. So hopefully he's listening as well. But I know it's funny how things have come along. I mean, it wasn't long ago, Jimmy, right? Our kids were playing fire trucks.
And I kind of never outgrew it. While we got it going on here, Pat, you just mentioned, you know, venting in a high rise and stuff, something the suburban doesn't really have the opportunity. Are you there?
Yep, I'm here.
They have the opportunity to do, but cutting a roof, judging your effectiveness on ventilation and roof cuts.
Yeah, well,
it's a worthy topic. I mean, we're all of the same mindset. Now that everybody's got a radio, everybody wants to talk on it. But, you know, there's some real signs that you could use in selecting a location for us to cut. Not always the easiest thing to do. And certainly one of the, you know, things with the proliferation of truss roofs and stuff. The idea there is, you know, don't get off the ladder or, you know, they taught us to walk the ridge. They don't want you doing that anymore. You got to have a roof ladder and stuff like that. So why don't we kind of head in that direction?
Yeah, absolutely. They certainly. I mean, I'm a big proponent. When PL Vulcan does our ladder training classes that we've around the country, and there's different methods, and there's not any one way that everybody should be doing it. I don't believe in that. I don't believe that, you know, one department has everything right or does everything right. But I think you can learn from it. So with that being said, I think one of the things that we have to look at now, because of all the different construction styles that we have, that we can utilize either the ladder, and I mean that by the aerial ladder, proper positioning of that, which is what I was asking Will about from Tucson there. About, you know, the priority about putting the ladder truck in front of the building. Working off of that, working off of a tower ladder or a tower ladder bucket, platform, whatever you might call it, or off of a ground ladder, a roof ladder, you know, spreading our weight over more of a surface area. By doing that, using a there's different terms for it. It's basically a triangle cut. Some people call it a basket cut. Utilizing a three-sided cut that you're able to make a quick cut that is very easily expandable by three more cuts. And it depends upon what comes out of that hole. Depends upon whether I expand it or not. And what I mean by that is if you're getting a lazy, you know, smoke condition or a moderate smoke condition, what's moderate? Well, that is experience. But a moderate smoke experience, smoke condition, then, you know, the necessity to expand that hole might not be needed. If I get some violent, pushing, heavy, dark smoke coming out with a lot of volume and a lot of pressure, that means that there is a lot of pressure underneath that where you're standing or where your working platform is, and that, you know, that hole may need to be expanded. I have no problem walking on a particular roof, but I think we have to be careful about what we walk on. And, you know, we go to our older stock and we say, oh, it's got to be 2x10s or 2x12 roof boards that, or less, of course, 2x8, that we are, you know, this is, we've always walked on this. Well, that building could have had a fire in it, been renovated or whatever. Next thing you know, we have trusses in it. So even our older stock, bread and butter stuff that, you know, Boston or New England works on, could end up being a truss roof. And our feeling and our ability to be, you know, how long we could work on a particular platform, you know, may change. And again, that has to do with the, you know, our, you know, how we feel, you know, what we feel, what we see, what we observe.
Yeah. You know, I couldn't agree more, especially with the truss roof thing. You know, where I am in not far from Boston, just outside the city, you tend to take a lot of your lessons from the people that are doing the work, and you'll see Boston guys walking on a roof, and then we'll come here and do that, and it's two different types of construction. So it comes down, again, to know your own experience, know your district, know your own department. A 2.5-story wood frame in Mansfield could be fairly new construction and have a truss roof in it. And that's not to say that the truss roof is burning at the time, but, you know, we, as they say in all the study material, beware the truss. Now, that doesn't mean you can't ventilate vertically any longer. You know, another good friend of ours, a ladder company in the western part of the state, will tell you to take the gable end out. That's not a bad tactic in a case where you need topside ventilation. You know, you got to do the best you can when you can. You know, on spotting locations or holes, you know, back when we first started, and most of the people that we know first started, and we still use these tricks, you know, look for the dry spot on a roof that might have some mist or dew or whatever, melting snow, melting asphalt shingles, where the smoke is pushing through. But modern times now will tell us we have thermal imaging cameras, and you might be able to spot from the outside where the fire is in the building with the use of a camera, which give you a better idea of where you're going to cut the hole. And the whole reason I bring this up is, you know, the purpose for training is to build everybody's experience. And over the course of your career, and done it myself, I've seen lesser experienced people make it to the roof and immediately start cutting a hole right where they're at. You know, and oftentimes the gable end faces the street. They ladder one slope of the roof, but the fire's in the rear of the building. So that would involve walking the ridge or moving a ground ladder or extending a reach or something like that. So opening a roof just isn't getting there and cutting a hole. It's getting to the right spot and cutting the right size hole. You know, and you know, the books say 4x4, which would indicate is square. But Pat, you already mentioned a triangle type cut, and I think the lesson learned for everybody, it's square footage of ventilation. It's the size of the opening, not the shape, that makes the difference.
Oh, absolutely. I can't imagine. You know, there's no, and that's why, you know, if you read the books, you know, it's, again, going back to that SOP, SOG, it has to be this. It's like, well, you know, I get that, but you need to put a proper size hole for the proper situation. And certainly, if I was to make a 3x3 hole, you're not saving that homeowner any money by making a 3x3 hole as opposed to a 4x4 hole under the same set of circumstances. Yeah, but with that being said, so I guess, yes, size does matter in that respect. And I stole that off of...
Only the Irish guys say that.
Yeah. I'm stealing that off of one of our chat room people here. So I'm going to give him credit, but I won't tell you who it is, but he does work at the... State Academy, so I'll just put that out there. And he works pretty close to the State Academy too. I'll narrow it down in a city near the State Academy. So yes, size does matter. But no, in all seriousness, you do you're doing, you know, if the reason that you're making a hole is because you're trying to save money, when the end result may end up in more damage because you haven't accomplished what you're actually trying to do. So, you know, with that being said, I think you know there is a time and a place and an appropriate size, but I think a lot of times we have learned to walk on the roof. There are certainly times, depending upon the pitch of that roof, that's completely inappropriate. We're going to get cold weather in New England finally at the end. Not that I'm wishing for it, but this weekend, if we have any precipitation and the roof is any kind of, and it doesn't have to be ice, it could be any number of reasons, but we are in February almost, and, you know, any kind of ice or slippery surface that you come in contact with, off you go and down you come. And you know, and it doesn't happen very often, but that's one of those avoidable injuries, I think. And by utilizing proper footing and roof ladders and or I'm a big proponent of operating right off the a bucket. You know, yes, I am on a tower ladder, but a properly positioned tower ladder, if there's any suspect of the roof, you got a great working platform. You can't get any better than that, you know?
No, I agree wholeheartedly, and I think, you know, the other thing that the roof ladder does for you besides add traction is it disperses your weight over a much larger area, and how many times have you seen you know, just a localized collapse where one member puts one foot through a roof and, you know, might be stuck there long enough to receive burns, cuts, broken bone, whatever, where had the roof ladder been available, it would have dispersed the weight and it never would have been a fall. It never would have been an injury. So it adds more than one dimension to safety for you.
No, absolutely. And it may not even be as dramatic as a burn. It could be, you know, a foot going through, losing your balance, and, maybe just a close call. And, you know, some of that stuff is some of those close calls are really luck. You know, and luck that, you know, that member didn't fall off the roof or fall through the floor or fall through the roofing material. You know, whatever the case may be. But we can't go on luck because eventually our luck runs out. You know, so, and, you know, there is some, you know, widely publicized in videos of, you know, members. I think Will mentioned that from Tucson about the Phoenix guys falling through that terracotta roof. You know, pretty dramatic footage. But, you know, and I'm not questioning their tactics or questioning what happened or anything like that. I certainly wasn't there, but, and I'm not sure if a roof ladder was even involved at all, but you have to wonder what increase in safety that might have had if there was a roof ladder involved. And I'm not sure if there wasn't a roof ladder involved, but they certainly weren't operating on that roof ladder if it was there. So, and, you know, we're all and my guys are the same, and I get it. If the pitch is easy, it's, you know, certainly easy enough to walk across with a roofer's walk on an easy pitch. But again, you know, you get a loose shingle or a misstep, and, you know, the next stop is the ground. Not a good thing.
No, it's well, you've had better days. Now we've cut our hole, and you know, we need to be able to judge the effectiveness of our ventilation. And there's a number of different ways that you can do that. You know, if you're a newer member, the tendency might be to call the interior crews, call the engine that's on the fire floor trying to make the push in and directly asking them, are you getting a lift, or how's the ventilation, or what's your progress, or something to that effect. Sometimes horizontal communication like that can get you some very direct answers.
Yeah, absolutely, and certainly, I'm not sure what happened, Mr. Some people are saying that we're off the air, but I don't think we are because I'm hearing you okay. And if you're not hearing us, you might want to try to sign on and log off again. Not you, Jimmy. Don't you do it. But our people listening. We are still on the air. I agree with that. I think. Of course, if they can't hear me, and why am I saying that we're still on the air? Because they won't be able to hear me anyway.
Send out one of your infamous tweets.
Yeah, huh? How about that, you know? But, no, in all seriousness, yeah, I mean, you know, certainly maybe a question, you know, we went to a small fire the other day as a perfect example because it goes the other way, too. You know, when do we open the roof? It doesn't need to be open every time. We had a fire in the rear porch, first floor that got into the walls, first floor into the second floor. We were able to open it up between the first floor and the second floor, rear enclosed porch, and stop it there. My roof man said there was a significant amount of smoke that he could see on the top floor. Do we want the roof open? And we told him, no, hold off. And so to that effect, to that end, you could do it the same as what you were saying. You, you know, the roof is open, Chief. Is the engine company making any progress? Or go right to the engine that you're working with. In my case, Engine 28. Engine 28, are you getting any relief in there? Is it helping out? And they may not know right away, but if you're getting a significant amount of smoke or heat coming out of your hole, then I think you're doing the right thing.
Yeah, I would agree wholeheartedly. And one of the things that you know, in the absence of a radio, there's some very visible signs too that we can talk about. Oftentimes, we talk about once the hole is cut and the ceiling is punched through, you know, taking a step back and looking, and how high is that smoke and heat rising? Is it linear smoke rising, you know, a couple feet off the roof deck and starting to waft left and right? Or is it turbulent smoke that's rising higher than your head? And if that's the case, we say if smoke is rising taller than you are, then it's under pressure. And pressure means heat. You need to make the hole a little bit bigger. That might be a sign that you could use. You know, start pulling more roof boards if you have a long rake, or make additional cuts with the same hole. I don't know if making another hole is all that good of an idea unless you're on a very, very large roof, a commercial building or something like that. They don't seem to draft it the same way as bread and butter 2.5 or 3-story wood frame pitched or even flat roofs draft. But you know, that's one of the signs. You can look for the change in color of the smoke. If it's turbulent black and all of a sudden you're getting large volumes of steam out, then the engine company must be getting in there. It must be making a push, and you can save some radio traffic with that. The eave line might tell you, you know, particularly if you have a house that has knee walls, very often you cut a hole in the roof and you'll see the smoke reverse direction. It'll actually stop coming out of the eave lines and start coming out more at the hole that you cut. And it's another sign that you're being effective in the roof wall. But I don't know. I'm of the opinion that the hole can't be big enough.
I agree. I mean, but I think there's a definite time frame where, you know, it becomes a diminishing effect, you know, how much time do you spend on the roof? Right? You know, do you remove the whole roof? You know, or do you actually, you know, make a significant hole and go in and do something else more significant? You know, just because you make the roof, or just because your position at that particular incident is the roof person, and doesn't mean that you hang out on the roof. You know, it's finish your work and get off the roof. These guys and girls, and I've seen, you know, again, YouTube again or whatever, and they stand there with rakes or hooks in their hand, and they're just standing on the roof. And it's like, if the hole is open and you're happy with what's coming out of it, then retreat at the very least to the ladder. Don't stand on the roofing material. You know, get back to someplace that's safe, and then and then decide if, you know, either another hole or an expanded hole is warranted. I have seen some attic fires, you know, not all that often, that have required holes in, you know, different areas, and it's been proven to do that. You know, not often, but, you know, Queen Anne-type buildings, buildings with hip roofs, you know, dormer windows, things like that, that, you know, that may be prudent to have holes in various places. But typically one hole, whether it be expanded or not, is often all you need.
Clearly, and that doesn't mean that you're not going to cut the roof in a more of a overhaul type of operation, you know. If it was a well-involved attic and you cut a ventilation hole and the engine company was able to make a push, but you got two layers of shingles up there and, you know, plywood over roof boards, you may end up having to cut that roof in a couple of different places just for overhaul. You know, but intentionally going up and say, I'm going to make Swiss cheese out of this roof for ventilation is probably not the best idea that you could have.
Yeah, but we got, you know, again, you know, the conditions are going to be dictate what happens. I mean, certainly if you come across, you know, even maybe a finished attic with knee walls, you may have to put a hole, something, you know, we always talk about, you know, at the highest spot of that, of a pitched roof, that's where we're going to place our hole, but that may not be the case on knee walls completely. Milwaukee has a very interesting tactic on roof ventilation where, and, you know, again, I'm not judging what they do or anything like that, but they are exactly, Dave, what you just asked me, is they actually use a trench cut from the peak of the roof right down to the drip line. And what that accomplishes is most of Milwaukee's buildings, quite a few, are not only severely pitched, I mean severely high-pitched roofs, that steeply pitched roofs, I should say, that are have knee walls. And by them taking a circular saw, K-12 circular saw type saw, from the ridge line all the way down to the drip line, they open up not only the high end of it, but also the knee wall end of it. And their roofs, typically the older stock, their style roofs are ridge boards, 2x1x6s, 1x4. Usually, I guess, are 1x6s. Sometimes, I guess, are 1x8s, but typically, I think they're 1x6s. They're able to pull that out. We worked on this with a firefighter from Milwaukee out in when I was working with at FDIC in fire engineering, and it was quite a feat. I was a little skeptical at first, but once I saw it, whoa, what a trick that is. And what they'll do is put two side-by-side roof ladders on the steeply pitched roof with one saw and two members. They'll cut a roof in probably 45 seconds. It's a pretty quick cut right down. The saw is then passed from one to the other. And now these roof ladders are only about 3, maybe 4 feet apart, so it's pretty easy to pass the saw to the next member. He starts cutting from the ridge line down to the drip line, the drip edge, and that other member who made the first cut, it begins to pull the boards right from the top. So they're able to open up the roof very effectively, very quickly. It was pretty interesting. I told Dave Ricker and those guys from Milwaukee that I was, you know, I didn't say I was skeptical. I didn't believe it or anything like that, but boy, what a trick that was. It worked on it. There is video on it, Paul, as you asked me in the chat line. I don't know where it is, but I bet you if you Googled YouTube and went to roof operations in Milwaukee, you'll probably find it. If you don't, email me or text me, and I will get you one because I know they showed me one, and I probably have it in my archives. It is pretty they actually had a helmet cam, and which was what convinced me, other than seeing it actually being done. In the training drill that we had set up, the prop that we had set up, but they showed me they had a helmet cam going, and they actually showed me, and it when they opened up and you could see the knee wall and it was burning in the knee wall, it was pretty impressive. They got it done pretty quick.
A lot of Cape style houses have knee walls, and you can really get some rapid horizontal spread. I've seen knee walls. The Cape style houses that have louvered ends just above the gutter line for the ventilation, much like you and I would have in a peaked regular style gable end high at the ridge. They have them down by the gutter for horizontal ventilation, you know, for insulation purposes and stuff like that. And I remember working for one of our retired chiefs now that one of his favorite expressions was, "We suck at capes." You know, the fire would get into the knee wall, go left and right. We'd have a hole, and almost all of us would do the same thing. We'd cut it on the dormant side because it was easier to walk on and end up making a cut similar to what you're describing in Milwaukee. But that Milwaukee cuts, it speaks to what you were talking about earlier. It doesn't matter the shape of the cut. It's the location of the cut, and then it's really – the volume that the cut can release, the square footage, you know. So a rectangular cut of an appropriate size is and placed well is what you're after. And, you know, the basic premise here is to get rid of the convection. You know, everything's going up, make the chimney, make it in the right place, and you should be going. And certainly they figured it out in Milwaukee, undoubtedly a very experienced fire department. With a unique construction.
And actually, somebody just posted a video. It's called Truck 12 Roof Vent, and I just threw it up on video in YouTube. Again, YouTube, and it's a perfect. It's probably a news camera helicopter shot of exactly what I was talking about. So if you those who are listening that don't have the chat room on, go to Truck 12 Roof Vent on YouTube, Milwaukee, and it's a terrific video of what I just described. It shows the two roof ladders up, the two members operating. You could tell that there's a significant amount of smoke, definitely fire in the attic or in that space. And it shows it right from the beginning. They're operating with the saw going and going. It's a nice video just to see what, it's another tool in the tool chest, another way to do business. I'm not saying that everybody should do this, but it's certainly certainly one way to do it. I was very impressed with those guys. It's very, and again, it's what Milwaukee has to deal with. They end up, being very successful with what they do because of their conditions and their building construction.
It works out well. You know, we've talked an awful lot about residential fires, and that certainly is, I would say, the majority of the experience across the country in stuff. But regarding commercial building fires, we talk, you know, residential, there's a couple things. There's a couple big differences that go on there. You know, with the advent of chainsaws, whether you use the type with the guard, Echo makes them, or Steel makes them, and there's all kinds of the Snoop blade, like we have in our department that doesn't have a guard, they work very, very well residential settings, peaked roofs. They're lighter than the rotary saws. They tend to have a little bit less torque, so they seem to be easier to handle. But when you move from a residential fire to commercial industrial fire, not only does your tools change, but your ventilation tactics entirely need to change. There's a whole different arena there, and you know, some would even argue, and certainly I'm one of them, that it's an entirely different fire. When you move from a residential setting to a commercial industrial setting, you have to fight that fire differently.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and, you know, we got to think of, you know, we talk about protecting life and property, and I, you know, I know property's there, and I know I get that, but it is certainly life and property. Life is also the fire service, the members of the fire department. So we need to be keeping that in the back of our minds too. Is the building occupied? Is it savable? Is it even savable? Is it, you know, what I mean, those are some of the questions that we need to be asking ourselves anyway. And so those are so to go to what you were saying, yes, Jimmy, I couldn't agree more. That is definitely a different tactic.
It was a couple of examples came up. I know when you were working on the other side of the city with Ladder 26, there was a night where you, I know Teddy was on the fire, Car 5 fire, a block of stores, but it was a storefront church, and members of the truck got up there figuring that it was going to be a typical commercial roof, rotary saw job. Ordinary construction, probably built up tar and gravel, and they reported that the roof was spongy. So, you know, conflicting reports. You're looking at what the fire is telling you, and that you should be able to operate on that roof pretty much all day long, and it was spongy. And just like you had mentioned earlier, site of a previous fire and where the storefront church had been built, they put a truss roof in right next to ordinary construction. And you know, a wood truss roof, and the roof failed within seconds of the members leaving the roof.
As a matter of fact, as the members were leaving, they were at the parapet wall as it was coming down. He had to jump and hold on to the parapet wall as this hinged down. He was lucky that it didn't. Typical to, and this was roll bar truss roof, that it failed, you know, I guess slowly, for lack of better terms, and it leaned in farthest away from the front parapet, the A side of the building, side one, if you're using numbers, to where he was. And so when he was able to, it actually allowed him to jump and grab the parapet and not ride the roof down. It was something to be said. To see that later, I don't recall if I did. I bring you up there to show you the building, or
I saw pictures.
Okay, yeah. We went up there the next day. I like to try to, if possible, go to fire scenes and again to learn. I mean, I am you know, I don't care how long you've been on, you can learn something. If you don't see something yourself, you can certainly share what you see with your other members who may not have seen it, that particular incident. So anyway, with that being said, we went up there the next day and we talked about it and was able to see how it failed. You know, it may not fail that way every time, but for the guys that were with me that day, we were able to see that incident and understand it, even though they weren't at the fire.
Yeah, and it's like we talked about very early on in tonight's broadcast, that it's critical. How many times have you told the recruits, retrace your steps? You know, tell new company officers, or as a company officer yourself, or when you're in the red card, you just, you know, the fire's all knocked down, and then you get in and say, all right, what really went on here? And why did I have difficulty in this side, or why couldn't we stretch the line up that stairwell, or what did this interior report mean? If you retrace those steps, you can learn an awful lot, just like in that happened. Sizing up commercial roofs. Again, big difference here. I'm thinking of you know, very popular program that's out there now, The Art of Reading Smoke, and a great statement that comes out of that, that a little bit of smoke from a very large building is a big problem. And that, you know, it, where I'm at, we have a very large industrial park. The smallest building in the industrial park probably covers some 30 to 50,000 square feet, but we have them in over 400,000 square feet. And you know, that can be a bit of a challenge to us as well. But the difference in some of these roofs, metal deck roofs with trusses and stuff that are placed, you know, further apart than the 16 on center roof rafters that we might be used to, they could be 24 or more inches apart with truss and purlin systems. And now you go to cut that roof, and all of a sudden you're standing on an unsupported roof deck. And there's a whole different set of circumstances that can come with that, too. You know, I think that's worth it. You know, we talk about hitting a skylight and stuff, but a person of lesser experience might not realize that you got to walk away sometimes to get to that. And more recently, a great trick, have the members on the engine company hit the roof line so we can tell where they are, or rake the stream across the ceiling. And it gave the members on the roof a better idea where they had to cut their hole.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, those are all the little subtle things you begin to look at. As a probationary fireman, you know, the new guy, if you will, or girl, that you are looking at maybe not the bigger picture. And what I mean by is if, you know, you're a new person and you're right in the open up position, the irons position, and that's all you're thinking about. You're not looking at the bigger picture. You know, you're thinking about that door that you need to open, or the apartment door that you need to get open. Or if you're a nozzle person, you're, you know, thinking about stretching the line. The more time you get on the job, and especially company officers have to be starting to look at the bigger picture. You know, try to take it all in. But I think that's one of the things that that a new person has to learn and understand, is that we need to be looking at, you know, the overall picture. Even if you're the first run out the door, you know, you need to be thinking about, you know, the size up. We say it often, the size up starts, you know, the moment the alarm bell goes off. And as a matter of fact, I always say the size up starts the moment you walk in the door to the firehouse. I look at weather forecasts. I look at, you know, what kind of crew do I have? Do I have, you know, inexperienced guys as opposed to all seasoned veterans, you know, or do I have a mix? You know, so that's part of my size up right then and then there. I think, I think that's some of the things that we have to look at, you know?
Exactly. I mean, if you're going to have to, because of inexperience and maybe the department doesn't have a standard operating procedure on when a commercial roof is going to be open, what tools to take and whatever, if the company officer or senior man on the truck is going to end up having to, you know, make those decisions at hand, it helps to understand that this is a very different fire. You know, you're not going to bring a pickhead axe to a commercial roof. Some of the commercial roofs that you may bring it, but you're not going to be real successful, and you're probably going to have a good case of bursitis by the time you get off the roof, you know. not to mention a couple of pissed off hose jockeys. So, you know, we call
firemen helpers.
Yeah.
I mean that just kiddingly, okay?
Yeah, right. And it just, you know, I think it bodes well to understand that it's a vastly different fire and stuff. And here's a rule that's worth talking about, too. There should be no need to cut a sprinkled building's roof. Well, like all of the rules that we've happened across, Nothing in this business, I don't think, is that hard and fast. And, you know, certainly when you get into certain circumstances, you know, you keep talking about it all night, Pat, size up. You know, if your size up dictates that you need to make a roof opening, then that's what's indicated. You got to do it. And, you know, if you have heavy smoke rolling, it's staying low, you're not getting any kind of lift. That lift isn't going to get any better. In fact, it's going to get a lot worse when sprinkler heads start popping. And if the fuel configuration inside a building or the building construction itself or the fire itself dictates that we're going to go beyond what NFPA likes to brag about, most fires are controlled within three sprinkler heads, you start popping more heads or you know, things like that, then a roof cut is going to be indicated.
Yep, absolutely. You know, I think, and that goes back to what we were saying earlier, is that, you know, hard and fast rules, I don't think are appropriate to the fire service, but guidance, you know, guidance, instructions, things written down are a good thing.
Yeah, clearly. I mean, you know, and I think forums like this are a way to do that. You know, you talk to two people that have equivalent time on the job, but kind of opposite ends of the spectrum as far as experience goes. You know, yours is very urban, mine is very suburban, and how the same concept, roof ventilation, applies in both settings. How do you get it done versus how I might have to get it done? The wins and the wears and stuff like that. A lot of what I deal with, fires in our industrial park or single-family homes with no exposures, you can assume certain, I don't know if you want to say ventilation risks. You know, we can rely on windows certainly a lot more than you can. You know, when you have rows of three deckers and two and a halfs, that, you know, literally a shoulder width apart, it's not in your best interest to rely on horizontal ventilation because fire may just impinge on the building next door if that's your sole ventilation method, you know. So your emphasis on vertical ventilation may be maybe a lot more appropriate than it might be in my suburban setting where critical exposures are few and far between.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's funny you mentioned that is, you know, I mean, people move from different departments occasionally, different jobs, and, you know, like you, but, you know, maybe not, you know, you kind of stayed in New England area. When people go from one end of the coast to the other end of the coast, it's certainly a different it's a different mindset. It's a different way of doing business, even though it's the same. We can learn from each other. But, you know, like Milwaukee's example that we gave a few minutes ago, there are certain tactics that have developed and matured, if you will, over time because of specific incidents and because of specific problems that they and as a result of that problem have developed. And, you know, to say one thing is wrong or doesn't work or shouldn't be done is maybe not appropriate in all cases. And, again, I think we could all learn and, you know, I think we, you know, I always call it a filter. We should be filtering, you know, the stuff we learn and the stuff we look at on YouTube. We should be filtering the things that we listen to in or read in the trade magazines. What's appropriate to you may be different and maybe not appropriate to, you know, another department. I think that's one of the things that why we are reasonably successful in as with PL Vulcan is because we don't preach the way it should be done, but what we'll do is share what we've been lucky enough to learn and experience, both yourself, me, Mark, Jimmy Sanders, and Jimmy Payne, and all the people that we have, and all the infinite amount of areas of expertise that we have, and the areas that we've experienced, that able to share that, and I think that's why I enjoy what we do so much. It works out well. We tap a lot of different experience, a lot of different knowledge from a lot of different people, and then just share that.
Yeah, I think you raise a great point, Pat. And we benefit from each other's experience, and even whatever we can relay to whoever our student body might be at that point. But then it's their can-do attitude that kind of gets it done for them. You know, they might look at it. I know recently we were teaching a class in a department that didn't have a ladder truck. Well, if it doesn't have a ladder truck, it doesn't mean the truck work doesn't get done. And, you know, after a couple of minutes of speaking with those guys, we realize that they're doing things differently than we do. They carry 35s, and I think they even had a 40 on one of their engines. And and they were very used to, and it was commonplace for them to throw these ground ladders to the roof and operate off of ground ladders much more than even I'm used to. You know, we've always had a ladder truck in every department that I've been on, and the trucks operate similar to New England trucks, you know, stick to the roof and emphasis on vertical ventilation, and, you know, try to get a ground ladder or two up to the floor above the fire or something like that. These members were totally dependent and pretty good at it, actually, on an engine company that had a 40-foot ground ladder, you know, and that's some load of work, too.
Yeah.
40,
so,
you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It sure is. It sure is. Well, just one more thing real quick before we wrap it up. I just wanted to touch base very quickly. We did the last month when Mark and I were talking about it, but it was an incident a couple 3 weeks ago, again, about an injured firefighter, and the social media, and how fast information is put out. Again, I mentioned YouTube. You know, it may be posted on YouTube before you even get back to the firehouse. And the same with injuries. We need to be careful. There were some injuries. It doesn't make any difference where or when or who or anything like that. But the point was that the family found out about injuries and very serious injuries before via social media before they were actually notified. So, you know, it's we have to be careful. I think we have to police ourselves and be careful about what we post, and we can't be, you know, in the, you know, thinking what we hear on the radio, or thinking what we might have seen on or might have heard on, whether it be a chat room or whatever it may be, that we don't put it on social media, you know, right away. We don't can't be that fast to put it on, because, like in this particular case, we could, people, you'd be surprised how many people look and listen. And I think we got to be policing ourselves. I just saw something, and I don't even know what town or city it was, but the IAFF, was talking about, a ban on a particular department about banning, you know, or not banning, but policing our social media posts, and along this subject, similar but different. But so I think that's just something I wanted to mention and get out there.
I couldn't agree with you more. It's probably, you know, I know that we just recently ran classes at the Mass Academy. I know that the Rhode Island Academy is doing a lot of work with it. And here's a basic guideline for you. Keep it technical, not personal. And, you know, big difference. I'm very good friends with the command staff at our own police department, and they're amazed that, you know, a fire department website will have pictures of firefighters operating at any one incident or another. And my feeling on that is completely different. We need that stuff to learn from. Like we spoke of earlier, it's game film for us. We're on the law enforcement side, they're particularly sensitive to that because it could jeopardize, you know, the way any one case goes. You know, if written word doesn't exactly match, you know, whatever video somebody took or whatever, or still pictures somebody took because an officer or somebody might be writing from memory and doesn't have the benefit of hindsight and looking back at a photo, it's just a vastly different approach where I believe that having those pictures and the videos, you know, is imperative because not everybody in my department makes every fire. And, you know, in our after action, we seek those videos out. Having said that, if you keep it technical and not personal, it should be a good boundary to follow. And by personal, I mean exactly like that. And in just too many recent cases where, you know, firefighter so-and-so just fell down, it looks like they're doing CPR on them. Well, they might not be doing CPR on them at all. And the next thing you know, especially for people that, and most firefighters, I think, are like this, you know, you end up hanging around with just other firefighters. And the infamous words, right, television, telephone, telefireman. By the time, you know, by the time the correction gets out there and says, no, he didn't fall down, he had to, you know, reach under the vehicle to retrieve a tool, you know, it goes from, you know, A to Z and nothing flat. And we've seen this. It's harmful. I personally am not a big fan of social media, but in this setting, it's good. I have certainly been the victim of it. You know, like we talked about earlier, blogs are great things if you're going to use them as game film like we talked about, but if you're going to use them to kick the snot out of somebody else, then you should stay away from it. And by the same token, if you're passing on personal information, you should avoid that, you know. And it's I don't think it was the intended purpose anyway for social media, you know.
No, I agree. And I don't think it was meant for I'm not talking about anybody specific. I think it's just something that we need to police ourselves in general as, a, you know, as fire guys, you know. And this is the way – I mean, I got Facebook and Twitter going right in front of me. I mean, you know, I get that. I mean, it's a great tool. It's just – it's a matter of policing ourselves. It's a matter of making sure that we do the right things for the right people, and you know, and understanding that, you know, it is almost instantaneous. This information, the information we get out there is like huge, you know, quick. It's and sometimes it's not accurate, and sometimes it could create tremendous hurt. So
it's without emotion. It's not full sentences either. So
everything
is exactly. So,
All right. Well, I, Jimmy, unless you have something found, which I'm quite sure you do, but I got to work tomorrow. So,
yeah. No, I just want to thank you once again for the invitation.
One thing I did want to mention, though, is we're calling it the Northeast Fire Summit, Spring 2012. It's this March 2nd and March 3rd at the New Hampshire Fire Academy in Concord, New Hampshire. It's a fool's event. We have some presentations from Mike Clark of Hanover, Vermont Fire Department. Hanover, New Hampshire Fire Department, who's retired. He's going to moderating. We have Mike Lombardo, the Buffalo, New York Fire Commissioner, who's retired, who's going to be a keynote speaker on Friday night. Various presentations will be on scene training from New Jersey, and this is all on Saturday. We have traditions training, and that's from the greater Washington, D.C., Maryland area. And then yours truly by P.L. Vulcan Training Concepts. Both Mark and I are going to be presenting a seminar on May Day and fireground hazards that day. And then we're going to end it with a roundtable discussion where attendees will be able to submit their questions prior to whether it be specifically to an individual or specifically to a group or just to the group. It should be a great time. Courtyard Marriott in Concord, there's some reduced rates. New Hampshire Fire Academy is offering their academy for free if you're a New Hampshire firefighter. Otherwise, firefighters from out of town that want to stay at the New Hampshire Fire Academy, you can stay there for $40 a night. It's all on a webpage, which is either could be got there from P.L. Vulcan on scene or traditions sites. Or the New England, if you Googled New England Fools and got their website, is there's a link there. It's a Northeast Fire Summit, it's called. And, it again, it's March 2nd and 3rd. It's $40. I'm sorry, it's $50 for Fools members. And some people say I'm a fool, but I'm a Fools member. And $65 if you're not a Fools member. And this also includes breakfast and lunch on Saturday. So it's a pretty good deal to hear a bunch of, not including myself, a bunch of great, dynamic, up-and-coming speakers. It'll be a good time out with a great bunch of people. Saturday night, no doubt, will be a social as well, along with Friday night. So it'll be a good time, you know, so sign up early. I understand that it was going pretty well. So, sign up early and get your money in, and it should be a great time. And, of course, P.L. Vulcan Training Concepts, you can get us. We're online. We're on Facebook. You can catch me, Pat Nichols, on Facebook as well. Jim Puglio, you can't catch on Facebook, but you can call him if you know him. But certainly you can, any questions or anything like that, I'm always available. Facebook, Twitter, cell phone, whatever. And certainly through P.L. Vulcan Training Concepts, if anybody's interested in any kind of training, Mark Gregory, Jim Sanders, and numerous other very highly qualified and well-respected instructors and experienced members of the fire service are there too. So anybody who's out there is interested, feel free to look us up and get in contact with us. Yes, it is going back to that Northeast Fire Summit. Sunday will be a rehab. Betty Ford Clinic is open on Sunday. It should be a good time, nonetheless. It's all in all seriousness. It's a great time to meet people, like-minded people in the fire service that want to get learn something and share their experiences and no doubt have quite a few laughs. So that's all good. I want to thank everybody for, spending their evening with us. Jimmy, especially you, I thank you for joining me today. It certainly made a great show. I appreciate you showing up. I think, maybe we can talk to Mark and tell him not to bother. I mean,
It's a funny accent. I think you need to offset an accent in there or something. You're entirely welcome, Pat. Thanks very much for the invitation. It was fun. It was good to talk to people from around the country and address the points that you received via computer. So thanks again for everything, and I hope it was worth the time.
Yeah, I hope so too, Jimmy. And I know I had a great time. It was a good show. I appreciate it. And And we'll be talking. Thank you very much, Jimmy. And okay, thanks,
brother.
Everybody out there.
Stay safe.
Yep, be safe. Yep, thank you.